smooth, clean desk and gathered her purse. The brick walls of the office were papered with real estate brochures that few people had ever studied. She had rarely used the typewriter or received a phone call. For the most part, she read books all day, thought about her family, and occasionally her life before. Since her arrival in Pines, she had wondered if this was her afterlife. At the very least, it was her life after. After Seattle. After her job as a paralegal. After almost all of her relationships. After living in a free world that for all its complexities and tragedies still made sense. But in her 5 years here, she had aged, and so had others. People had died, disappeared, been murdered. Babies had been born. That didn't align with any concept of an afterlife she had heard of, but then again, by definition, how could you ever know what to expect outside the realm of the living, breathing human experience? Over the years of her residency, it had steadily dawned on her that Pines felt much closer to a prison than any afterlife, although perhaps there was no meaningful distinction. A mysterious and beautiful lifelong sentence. It wasn't just a physical confinement, but a mental one as well, and it was the mental aspect that made it feel like a stint in solitary. The inability to outwardly acknowledge one's past or thoughts or fears. The inability to truly connect with a single human being. There were moments, of course, few and far between. Sustained eye contact, even with a stranger when the intensity seemed to suggest the inner turmoil. Fear. Despair. Confusion. Those times, Teresa at least felt the warmth of humanity, of not being so utterly and helplessly alone. It was the fakeness that killed her. The forced conversations about the weather, about the latest crop from the gardens, why the milk was late, about everything surface and nothing real. In Pines, it was only ever small talk, and getting accustomed to that level of interaction had been one of the toughest hurdles to her integration. But every fourth Thursday, she got to leave work early, and for a brief window, the rules let up. Teresa locked the door behind her and set off down the sidewalk. It was a quiet afternoon, but that was nothing new. There were never loud ones. She walked south along Main Street. The sky was a staggering cloudless blue. There was no wind, no cars. She didn't know what month it was. Only time and days of the week were counted, but it felt like late August or early September. A transitional quality to the light that hinted at the death of a season. The air mild with summer, the light gold with fall. And the aspen on the cusp of turning. The lobby of the hospital was empty. Teresa took the elevator to the third floor, stepped out into the hallway, checked the time. 3:29. The corridor was long. Fluorescent lights hummed above the checkered board floor. Teresa walked halfway down until she reached the chair sitting outside a closed, unmarked door. She took a seat. The noise of the light seemed to get louder the longer she waited. The door beside her opened. A woman emerged and smiled down at her. She had perfect white teeth and a face that struck Teresa as both beautiful and remote. Unknowable. Her eyes were greener than Teresa's, and she'd pulled her hair back into a ponytail. Teresa said, "Hi, Pam." "Hello, Teresa. Why don't you come on in?" The room was bland and sterile. White walls absent any painting or photograph. Just a chair, a desk, a leather divan. "Please," Pam said in a smooth voice that sounded vaguely robotic, gesturing for Teresa to lie down. Teresa stretched out on the divan. Pam took a seat in the chair and crossed her legs. She wore a white lab coat over a gray skirt and black-rimmed glasses. She said, "It's good to see you again, Teresa."
"You too."
"How have you been?"
"Okay, I guess."
"I believe this is the first time you've come to see me since your husband's return."
"That's true."
"Must be so good to have him back."
"It's amazing."
Pam slid the pen out of her lapel pocket and clicked out the tip. She turned her swivel chair toward the desk, put the pen to a legal pad with Teresa's name scrawled across the top, and said,
"Do I hear a but coming?"
"No, it's just that it's been 5 years. A lot has happened."
"And now it feels like you're married to a stranger?" We're rusty. Awkward. And of course it's not like we can just sit down and talk about Pines. About this insane situation we're in. He's thrown back into my life, and we're expected to function like a perfect family unit. Pam scribbled on the pad.
How would you say Ethan is adapting?
To me?
To you, to Ben, his new job, everything.
I don't know. Like I said, it's not like we can communicate. You're the only person I'm allowed to really talk to.
Fair enough. Pam faced Teresa again. Do you find yourself wondering what he knows?
What do you mean?
You know exactly what I mean. Ethan was the subject of a fete, and the only person in the history of Pines to escape one. Do you ever wonder if he made it out of town? What he saw? Why he returned?
But I would never ask him.
But you wonder.
Of course I do. It's like he died and came back to life. He has answers to questions that haunt me, but I would never ask him.
Have you and Ethan been intimate yet? Teresa felt a deep blush flooding through her face as she stared up at the ceiling.
Yes.
How many times?
3.
How was it? None of your fucking business. But she said,
the first 2 times were a little clunky. Yesterday was far and away the best.
Did you come?
Excuse me?
There's nothing to be ashamed of, Teresa. Your ability, or lack thereof, to have an orgasm is a reflection on your state of mind, Pam smirked.
And possibly Ethan's skills. As your psychiatrist, I need to know.
Yes. Yes, you had one?
Yesterday I did.
Teresa watched Pam draw an O with a smiley face inside it.
I worry about him, Teresa said.
Your husband?
He went out in the middle of the night last night. Didn't come back until dawn. I don't know where he went. I can't ask. I get that. I assume he was chasing someone trying to leave.
Do you ever have thoughts about leaving?
Not in several years.
Why is that?
At first I wanted to. I felt like I was still living in the old world. Like this was a prison or an experiment. But it's strange. The longer I stayed here, the more it became normal.
What did?
Not knowing why I was here. What this town really was. What was beyond.
And why do you think it became more normal to you?
Maybe this is just me adapting or giving in, but I realized that as strange as this town was, it wasn't all that different from my life before. Not when I really held them up against each other. Most interaction in the old world was shallow and superficial. My job in Seattle was as a paralegal working for an insurance defense firm, helping insurance companies fuck people out of their coverage. Here, I sit in an office all day long and hardly talk to anyone. Equally useless jobs, but at least this one isn't actively hurting people. The old world was filled with mysteries beyond my understanding, the universe, God, what happens when we die. And there are plenty of mysteries here. Same dynamics, same human frailties. It just all happens to exist in this little valley.
So you're saying it's all relative?
Maybe.
Do you believe this is the afterlife, Teresa?
I don't even know what that means. Do you?
Pam just smiled. It was a facade, no comfort in it. Pure mask. The thought crossed Teresa's mind, and not for the first time, who is this woman I'm spilling all my secrets to? To some extent, the exposure was terrifying. But the compulsion to actually connect with another human being tipped the scales. Teresa said,
I guess I just see Pines as a new phase of my life.
What's the hardest thing about it?
About what? Living here?
Yeah.
Hope?
What do you mean by that?
Why am I continuing to breathe in and out? I would think that's the hardest question for everyone stuck in this place to answer.
And how do you answer it, Teresa?
My son? Ethan? Finding a great book? snowstorms. But it's not like my old life. There's no dream house to live for, no lottery. I used to fantasize about going to law school and starting my own practice, becoming fulfilled and rich, retiring with Ethan somewhere warm with a clear blue sea and white sand, where it never rains.
And your son? Teresa hadn't seen it coming. Those three little words hit her with the sneaky power of a surprise right. The ceiling she'd been staring at disappeared behind a sheet of tears.
Ben's future was your biggest hope, right? Pam asked.
Teresa nodded, and when she blinked, two lines of salt water ran out of the corners of her eyes and down her face.
His wedding? Pam asked.
Yeah.
An illustrious career that made him happy and you proud?
It's more than that.
What?
It's what I was just talking about. Hope. I want it so badly for him, but he'll never know it. What can the children of Pines aspire to be? What foreign lands do they dream of visiting?
Have you considered that maybe this idea of hope, at least the way that you conceive of it, is a holdover from your past life that serves no purpose?
You're saying abandon hope, all ye who enter here?
No, I'm saying live in the moment. That maybe in Pines there's joy to be had in just surviving. That you continue to breathe in and out because you can breathe in and out. Love the simple things you experience every day. All this natural beauty. The sound of your son's voice. Ben will grow up to live a happy life here.
How?
Has it occurred to you that your son may no longer share your old world concept of happiness? That he's growing up in a town that cultivates exactly the sort of in-the-moment living I just described?
It's just so insular.
So take him and leave.
Are you serious?
Yes.
We'd be killed.
But you might escape. Some have left, though they've never returned.
Do you secretly fear that, as bad as you think it is in Pines, it could be a million times worse on the outside?
Teresa wiped her eyes.
Yes.
One last thing, Pam said. Have you opened up to Ethan about what happened prior to his arrival? Your, living situation, I mean?
Of course not. It's only been 2 weeks.
Why haven't you?
What's the point?
You don't think your husband deserves to know?
It would only cause hurt.
Your son might tell him.
Ben won't. We already talked about it.
Last time you were here, you rated your depression on a scale of 1 to 10 as a 7. How about today? Are you feeling better, worse, or the same?
The same.
Pam opened a drawer and took out a small white bottle that rattled with pills.
You've been taking your medication?
Yes,
Teresa lied. Pam set the bottle on the desktop.
1 a day, at bedtime, just like before. It'll last you until our next appointment.
Teresa sat up. She felt like she always did after these things finished, emotionally ragged.
Can I ask you something?
Teresa said.
Sure.
I assume you talk to a lot of people, hear everyone's private fears. Will this place ever feel like home?
I don't know, Pam said as she stood.
That's entirely up to you.
Chapter 5. The morgue was in the basement of the hospital through a pair of windowless doors, far end of the east wing. Pilcher's men had arrived ahead of Ethan with the body, and they stood in jeans and flannel shirts outside the entrance. The taller of the two, a man with Nordic features and head of Pilcher's security team, looked visibly upset. "Thanks for bringing her down," Ethan said as he moved past and shouldered through one of the doors. "You don't have to wait."
"We were told to wait," the blonde said.
Ethan shoved the door closed after him. The morgue smelled like a morgue, antiseptic not quite masking the embedded musk of death. The flooring was white tile, badly stained and slightly concave, with a large drain in the center. Alyssa lay naked on the stainless steel autopsy table. The sink behind the table was leaking, the sound of dripping water echoing off the walls. Ethan had only been inside the morgue once before. He hadn't liked it then, and he found it infinitely less charming with a corpse in situ. There were no windows, no other source of light but the examination lamp. Standing next to the autopsy table, everything beyond was lost to darkness. Over the drip, drip, drip came the hum of the refrigerated morgue drawers, a stack of six stationed against the wall beside the sink. The truth was, he didn't know what he was doing. He wasn't a coroner by a long shot, but Pilcher had insisted he examine the body and produce a report. Ethan set his Stetson on the organ scale above the sink. Reaching up, he took hold of the lamp. In the hard light, the wounds looked clean, neat, impeccable. No ragged skin, just dozens and dozens of black windows into devastation. The woman's skin was the color of primer under the burn. He went appendage by appendage, studying the punctures. It grew harder with her lying dead on a table under this cruel clinical light to think of her as Alyssa. He raised her left arm into the light and studied her hand. There was dirt under her fingernails. Or blood. He imagined her hands desperately pushing into the fresh wounds, fighting to snatch the blood that must have been pouring out of her. So why, aside from the oak leaf fragments in her hair, was she otherwise clean? Without a trace of blood or blood stain on her skin? He hadn't seen any blood where he'd found her in the road. She'd obviously been killed elsewhere and moved to that place. Why had they drained her blood? To transport her without leaving a trail, or something more sinister? Ethan studied her other arm, her legs. He didn't want to, but he shined the light briefly between her thighs. No bruising or damage evident to his untrained eye that might suggest sexual assault. Because he couldn't help but handle her body gently, it took him three tries to roll her over. Her arms clanged against the metal table. He brushed the bits of gravel and dirt off her back. There was a recent wound on the back of her left leg, a scarred over incision. The cut made, he guessed, to extract her microchip. He pushed the light away and eased down onto the steel adjustable stool. The way she lay draped across the cold table, exposed, degraded, ignited something inside of him. Ethan sat in the dark wondering if Kate could really have done this. After a while, he got up and walked to the door. Pilcher's men stopped talking when he stepped out. He looked at the tall blonde and said, "Could I speak with you for a minute?"
"In there?"
"Yeah." Ethan held the door, and the man walked into the morgue. "What's your name?" Ethan asked.
"Alan."
Ethan pointed to the stool. "Have a seat."
"What is this?"
"I'm asking you a few questions." Alan looked dubious.
"I was told to bring her here and put her into cold storage when you were finished."
"Well, I'm not finished."
"Nobody said anything about answering questions."
"Quit flexing and sit down." The man didn't move. He had a good 4 inches on Ethan. His shoulders were miles apart. Ethan could feel his body priming for a fight, heart rate ramping, battle trance coming on. He didn't want to throw first, but if he didn't have surprise, if he didn't bring Alan down in the first few seconds, the likelihood of beating this man who was built like a Norse god seemed a bit of a stretch. Ethan dropped his chin an inch. A half second before he exploded off the balls of his feet and drove his forehead into the man's face, Alan turned and took a seat as instructed.
"This isn't what I was told," Alan said.
"David Pilcher, your boss, has given me unlimited access, unlimited resources to find out who did this. You want me to find out, don't you?"
"Of course I do."
"Did you know Alyssa?"
"Yeah." "There are only 160 of us in the mountain."
"So it's a tight-knit group."
"Very."
"Were you aware of Alyssa's activities in Pines?"
"Yep."
"So you two were close." Alan stared at her body on the table. The muscles in his jaw fluttered. Rage. Sadness. "Had you been intimate with her before, Alan?"
"Do you know what happens when 160 people live in close quarters, knowing they're all that's left of mankind?"
"Everybody fucks everybody?"
"You got it." We're a family in that mountain. We've lost some of our own before. Mostly nomads who never returned, got themselves eaten. But never anything like this. Everybody's shaken up? Big time. You know, that's the only reason Pilcher's letting you do this, right? He banned everyone from investigating her death. Because of retaliation. A subtle, raging smile tugged at the corner of Alan's mouth. Do you have any concept of the slaughter I could rain down on this town with a team of 10 armed men? You understand not everyone in Wayward Pines is responsible for her death. Like I said, there's a reason Pilcher's letting you run this show. Tell me about Alyssa's assignment. I knew she was living with the townies, but no details, really. When's the last time you saw her? 2 nights ago. Sometimes Alyssa would come back to the mountain to stay the night. It was strange. You ever seen our barracks? I think so. There are no windows. We're talking small, cramped, impersonal spaces. In Pines, she got to live in a house all to herself, but she missed sleeping in her room in the mountain. Go figure. Considering who she was, she could have lived anywhere, done whatever she wanted, but she pulled her weight. She was one of us. What do you mean by considering who she was? You don't know? Know what? Fuck. Look, it's not my place to talk about this. What am I missing? Forget it, okay? Okay, for now. So where'd you see her last? Ethan asked. Mess hall. I was finishing up my meal when she walked in. She got her tray and came over. What'd you talk about? Alan stared off into the dark beyond the light. He looked briefly at peace, as if the memory of it pleased him. Nothing profound. Nothing memorable. Just about our day. We'd both been working our way through the same book, and we talked about our impressions so far. Other stuff too, but that's all that sticks out. She was my always friend, and my sometimes lover. We were at ease with each other, and I didn't know it was the last time I would ever see her alive. You didn't discuss her work in town? I think I asked how her mission was coming along, and she said something like, it'll all be over soon. What do you think she meant by that? I don't know. And that was it? That was it. Why would Pilcher ask you to transport her body? Kind of insensitive, considering I requested the assignment. Oh. Ethan was annoyed to discover that he was beginning to like Alan. He'd been to war with men like him, recognized that hard decency, fearlessness, and loyalty backed by awesome physical strength. Was there anything else, Ethan?
No.
Find who did this.
I will.
And hurt them. You want a hand putting her in the drawer? No, I'll take care of it. But first, I'd like to sit with her for a little while.
Sure.
Ethan reached over and grabbed his hat off the organ scale. At the doors, he stopped and glanced back. Alan had scooted the stool within range of the autopsy table, and he was reaching out for Alyssa's hand. Chapter 6 Teresa sat on the front porch waiting for her husband. The leaves of the aspen tree in the front yard were fluttering and making shushing noises, and the light passing through the branches smeared quivering shadows across the greener-than-astroturf grass. She spotted Ethan walking down 6th Street, moving slower than his usual pace. His gait was off, and he favored his right leg. He turned off the sidewalk and came up the stone path. She could see that it was hurting him to walk, but the tension in his face vanished behind a wide smile when he saw her.
"You're hurting," she said.
"It's nothing." Teresa got up and moved down the steps into the grass that was already cool against her sandaled feet. She reached up and touched a lavender-colored bruise on the left side of his face. He winced.
"Did someone hit you?"
"No, it's fine."
"What happened?"
"I wrecked the cruiser."
"When?"
"Last night. It's not a big deal."
"Did you go to the hospital?"
"I'm fine."
"You didn't get checked out?"
"Teresa,
what happened?"
A rabbit or something ran out in front of the car. I swerved to miss it. Flipped.
You flipped?
I'm okay. We're going to the hospital right now. He leaned down, kissed her forehead. I'm not going to the hospital. Drop it. You look beautiful. What's the story?
There has to be a story if I look beautiful.
You know what I mean.
You forgot.
Entirely possible. It's been a crazy couple of days. What I forget?
We have dinner at the Fishers.
That's tonight?
15 minutes.
For a moment she thought he might say they weren't going, that they would just cancel. Could he do that? Did he have that power? All right. Let me get out of these nasty clothes, and I'll be back down in 5. Teresa had spoken to Mrs. Fisher 2 weeks ago at the Saturday morning farmer's market, a friendly exchange after they'd both reached for the same cucumber. Then one evening last week, the Burke's phone had rung. The voice on the other end introduced herself as Megan Fisher. She wanted to invite Ethan and Teresa over for dinner on Thursday the week following. Could they join? Of course, Teresa knew that Megan hadn't woken up that morning with a burning desire to make new friends. Megan had gotten a letter in the mail suggesting that she reach out to the Burkes. Teresa had received her share of similar letters, and she figured that on some level it made sense. Considering the prohibition on real human contact, she would never take it upon herself to initiate get-togethers with her neighbors. It was all too strained and strange. So much easier to just disappear into your own private world. Teresa and Ethan walked down the middle of the street holding hands, Teresa clutching a loaf of bread in her right arm that was still warm from the oven. With Ben at home, it felt like she and Ethan had snuck out for a date night. The lush coolness of evening had settled into the valley. They were running a little late, already a few minutes past 7. Dinner with Hector had begun, the velvet beauty of his piano creeping through every open window.
"Do you remember what Mr. Fisher does?" Teresa asked.
"He's a lawyer. His wife's a teacher. Ben's teacher." Of course, Teresa knew she was Ben's teacher, but she wished Ethan had mentioned it. The school was a strange place. Education in Pines was compulsory from age 4 to 15, and the curriculum was a mystery. She had no idea what her son was learning there. Kids never had homework and were forbidden from discussing what they learned with anyone, including their parents. Ben never shared, and she knew better than to pry. The only time they were allowed a window into that world was the end-of-year play. It happened in June, and around Wayward Pines the celebration rivaled Christmas and Thanksgiving. 3 years ago, a fate had been called on a parent who forced his way into the school. She wondered how much Ethan knew.
"What kind of law does Mr. Fisher practice?" Teresa knew it was a stupid question. All likelihood, Mr. Fisher sat in a silent, rarely visited, rarely called office all day, just like she did.
"Not sure," Ethan said. "We'll have to put that on our list of things to talk about." He squeezed her hand. It was sarcasm in her husband's voice. No one else would have picked it up, but to her it was biting. She looked up at him, smiled. Something shared and knowing in his eyes, the intimacy of an inside joke. It was the closest she'd felt to him since his return. She could envision a lifetime spent trying to create such flashes of connection. The Fishers lived in a cozy house at the northern edge of town. Megan Fisher opened the door before Ethan even had a chance to knock. She was mid-20s and very pretty in a white dress with lace along the bottom. The brown headband that kept her hair back was the same color as her tanned, freckled shoulders. Her smile reminded Teresa of a movie star smile, toothy and wide, and if you stared too hard at it, not quite real.
"Welcome to our home, Teresa and Ethan. We're so thrilled you could make it."
"Thanks for having us," Ethan said. Teresa presented the bread wrapped in cloth. Megan cocked her head disapprovingly.
"Now, I told you not to bring a thing." She accepted it nonetheless. "Oh, it's still warm. Fresh out of the oven. Please come in."
Teresa reached up and swiped Ethan's cowboy hat.
"I can take that," Megan said. The house smelled like supper, and supper smelled good.
The heat coming out of the kitchen brought with it chicken roasting with garlic and potatoes. Brad Fisher was in the dining room, arranging the last of four place settings at an elaborately candled table. He walked into the foyer with a smile and a hand outstretched. 2 or 3 years older than his wife and still wearing, Teresa guessed, his work clothes, black wingtips, gray slacks, a tieless white Oxford with the sleeves rolled halfway up his forearms. He looked like a young lawyer, exuding a streak of hard, scrappy intelligence.
"Sheriff, great to have you in our home."
"Great to be here."
"Hello, Mrs. Burke. Please, Teresa." Megan said, "I've got a couple things to finish up before we sit down. Teresa, want to help me in the kitchen? Perhaps the guys can enjoy a beverage on the back porch?"
Teresa washed a bag of salad greens. Through the window over the sink, she could see Ethan and Brad standing out in the grass with glasses of whiskey. She couldn't tell if they were actually talking. The yard was fenced. It backed right up against a cliff that soared over 1,000 feet in a series of dwindling pine-studded ledges.
"Megan, you have a beautiful home," Teresa said. "Thank you. You're too kind." "I believe you're teaching my son this year."
She didn't mean to say it. The words just came. It could have been an awkward moment, but Megan recovered graciously.
"I sure am. Ben's a lovely boy, one of my best,"
and offered nothing else. Their conversation moved in fits and starts. Teresa sliced a warm beet into livid purple medallions.
"Where do you want these?" she asked. "Right here would be great."
Megan held out a wooden bowl, and Teresa scooped in 2 handfuls. She thought beets smelled like dirt in a weirdly pleasant way.
"You work in real estate, right?" Megan asked.
"I do."
"I've seen you through the storefront window, sitting behind that desk," she leaned in confidentially. "Brad and I are trying, if you know what I mean."
"Really?"
"If we're successful and Mr. Stork brings us a special delivery, we'll be in the market for a bigger place. Maybe we'll come see you, let you be our agent. Show us some of the best properties Pines has to offer."
"I'd love to help out," Teresa said.
She still couldn't get over the strangeness of standing in Megan's kitchen like everything was normal. Megan had only come to town a couple of years ago, and her integration had been disastrous. She made 2 escape attempts, tried to claw the former sheriff's eyes out. Teresa could still remember sitting at her desk one afternoon and staring through the window as Megan broke down in the middle of Main Street in broad daylight, screaming at the top of her voice, "What the fuck is wrong with this place? What the fuck is wrong with this place? None of you are real." Teresa had expected a fate that night, but the phones had never rung. Megan vanished. 3 months later, Teresa saw her back in town, Megan walking down the sidewalk with a look of total peace. Soon she was teaching at the school, then married to Brad. Megan had played important roles in subsequent fates, had even wandered into the circle with a tire iron and dealt a blow to a dying runner. Now they were cooking together while their husbands drank whiskey outside. A question repeated in the back of Teresa's mind as she washed the purple stains from her hands. How did they finally break you? Ethan stared up at the cliff and sipped his whiskey. It was excellent, a Highland single malt. Aside from the awful-tasting beer on tap at the beer garden, you couldn't buy booze in town on a regular basis. Ethan supposed he understood Pilcher's thinking. Life in Wayward Pines was struggle enough. The presence of a liquor store might very well turn it into a town of drunks in short order. But every now and then Pilcher released a few bottles of good stuff into circulation. They'd turn up at the grocery store as expensive pours in the restaurant. And when the town was in a dry spell, people made their own.
"Scotch okay, Ethan?"
"It's great, thank you." Brad Fisher. Ethan had read his file for the 2nd time just last week. Born in Sacramento. Harvard Law grad. General counsel for a startup in Palo Alto. Brad had been traveling through Idaho on a 2-week summer road trip with his new bride when they'd stopped in Wayward Pines for a night. The report had been unspecific regarding whether Pilcher had orchestrated the same type of collision he'd used on Ethan and many others.
Like everyone else in Pines, the Fishers had woken up 1,800 years later in this beautiful prison of a town. 2 months after their arrival, the first Mrs. Fisher climbed one of the cliffs on the northern end of town and leapt 500 feet to her death. It had torn Brad up, but otherwise his integration had gone smoothly. No escape attempts, no erratic behavior. There was only one surveillance report in the man's file. A couple of exterior cameras had caught him on a later-than-approved walk one night following a fight with Megan. The report had ultimately received an NSA No Suspicious Activity rating, and Brad had never raised suspicion again.
"How's the new job treating you?" Brad asked.
"No complaints. Finally starting to get my sea legs."
"Tell me about your law firm."
"Oh, it's nothing special. Just my secretary and me. I call it a door practice. I handle whatever walks in the door."
"Like anyone has ever walked in your door."
They stood in the semi-dark in the shadow of the cliff and drank. After a while, Brad said,
"Sometimes I see mountain sheep on those cliff edges."
"Oh, yeah? Never seen one." 2 minutes of silence elapsed, and then Ethan commented on their garden. The punctuations of silence were completely uncomfortable. Ethan was beginning to understand that in Wayward Pines, these periods of shared quiet were normal, expected, inevitable. Some people, by nature, were better at surface conversation than others, better at walking the line, steering clear of forbidden topics. There was much more thinking before speaking, like living in a novel of manners. Ethan had encountered one or two residents who could engage with seemingly effortless speed on a deep well of approved subject matter. But as a whole, conversations in Pines unfurled at a measured, almost plodding pace, with a rhythm distinctly alien to the world before. It had been some time since Ethan had had liquor, and he already felt lightheaded, a sudden distance from the moment that troubled him. He set the glass of scotch on the fence and hoped it wouldn't be too much longer before their wives called them in to the table. Dinner was almost nice. They kept the small talk going and the conversation only stalled a handful of times. Even then, between the clink of silverware and Hector Gaither's piano playing on the tube radio, the silence was not unpleasant. Ethan was fairly certain he had seen this room before on one of Pilcher's monitors. If he wasn't mistaken, there was a camera embedded in the drywall in the corner of the ceiling above the china hutch. He knew for a fact that gatherings of three or more received monitoring priority from Pilcher's surveillance techs. They were being watched at this very moment. After dessert, they played Monopoly. Board games were hugely popular at dinner parties. With clearly defined rules, they allowed people to laugh, joke, and interact with more spontaneity and with a shared sense of purpose and competition. Men versus women. Teresa and Megan snagged Park Place and Boardwalk early on. Ethan and Brad focused on infrastructure, railroads, utilities, waterworks. A little before 9:30, Ethan landed their tiny metal shoe on Boardwalk. Bankruptcy ensued. The Burks waved back at the Fishers from the driveway, the young couple standing arm in arm in the illumination of the porch light. They yelled back and forth how much fun was had, made promises to get together again soon. Teresa and Ethan walked home. There was no one but the two of them. A cricket chirped from a hidden speaker in a bush they passed, and Ethan caught himself pretending that it was real, that all of this was real. Teresa rubbed her arms. "Want my jacket?" Ethan asked. "I'm fine." "Nice couple," Ethan said. "Please don't ever do that with me, darling."
"Do what?"
She glanced up at Ethan in the dark.
"You know."
"I don't."
"Surface conversation. Filling the silence with bullshit. I do it every day of my life, and I will continue to do as I'm told. But I can't stand it with you."
Ethan flinched internally, wondered if any microphone in the vicinity was capturing their conversation. From his limited experience in the mountain and studying surveillance reports, he knew it was hit or miss whether conversations were legible outside. Even if they were being recorded, it wasn't like Teresa was openly violating any rule.
but she was straying dangerously close into gray territory. She was acknowledging the strangeness and voicing dissatisfaction with the way of things. At the very least, their last exchange would generate a report.
"Be careful," Ethan said it at just above a whisper. She let go of his hand and stopped in the middle of the street, stared up at him through eyes beginning to sheet over with tears.
"Around who?" she asked. "You?"
In the middle of the night, Ethan's phone rang. He went downstairs, answered.
"I'm sorry about the late call," Pilcher said. "It's all right. Everything okay?"
"I had a word with Alan this evening. He said you two spoke in the morgue today."
"Yeah, he was helpful."
"This is hard," Pilcher said, his voice turning hoarse as if he'd begun to cry.
"Ethan, I need you to know something."
Chapter 7. Kahn Auditorium, Northwestern University, Chicago, 2006. The 1,000-seat auditorium was at capacity, and the lights shining up from the orchestra pit burned his eyes. 20 years ago, lecturing to a full house would have given him a rush to last for days, but he was long over the thrill. This lecture tour, beyond generating much-needed funds, wasn't pushing him any closer to completing his work. Lately, all he wanted was to be in his lab. With only 7 years left in this world, he needed to make every second count. As the applause died down, he forced a smile, looked up from his notes, and rested his hands on the lectern. He could do the opening by memory. Hell, he could do it all by memory, this being his 10th and last talk on the circuit. He began, "Suspended animation is not a concept of 20th century science. We didn't invent it. It belongs, like all the great mysteries of the universe, to nature. Consider the seed of a lotus plant. It can still germinate after 1,300 years. Bacterial spores have been discovered in bee amber, perfectly preserved and viable after tens of millions of years. And recently, scientists from Westchester University successfully revived bacteria that had been trapped for 250 million years inside salt crystals, deep underground. Quantum physics seems to hint at the possibility of time travel, and while intriguing, those are theories that only apply to particles on the subatomic level. Real time travel doesn't need wormholes or flux capacitors." Chuckles rippled through the auditorium. That line always sparked a laugh. He smiled out at all those faces he couldn't see. Like they weren't even there. Nothing but the crowd energy and the lights and the heat of the lights. He said, "Real-time travel is already here. Has been for eons, occurring in nature, and that's where we, as scientists, must look." It was a 40-minute presentation, and for the duration his mind was elsewhere, in the tiny town of Wayward Pines, Idaho, that was more and more feeling like home. With his collector, Javier, who had promised to deliver 10 new recruits by year's end. With the last phase of his research and the pending sale to the military, which would fully fund everything to come. When he'd finished, he took questions, people lining up behind a microphone, positioned at the front of the center aisle. The fourth question came from a biology student with long black hair. It was the inevitable question that had come at some point during every one of his lectures. She said, "Thanks so much for coming, Dr. Pilcher. It's been a real privilege to have you on campus these last few days. Pleasure's all mine. You've talked a lot about medical applications for suspended animation, using it to keep trauma patients in stasis until proper care can be administered. But what about what you alluded to at the beginning of your talk?"
"You mean time travel?" David said. "The fun stuff?"
"Exactly."
"Well, I was just trying to get your attention."
Everyone laughed.
"It worked," the student said.
"You're asking if I think it's possible?"
"Yes."
He took off his glasses, set them down on his leather notepad.
Well, it's certainly fun to dream about, isn't it? He said. Look, there have been successful tests on mice, deanimating them by initiating hypothermia, but as you can imagine, getting human test subjects to sign up for such an experiment is a whole other matter, especially long-term dormancy. Is it possible?
Yes,
I think so. But we're still decades away. For now, I'm afraid, suspended animation as a time travel application for humanity is the stuff of bad science fiction. They were still clapping as he walked off stage. The young overachieving escort who'd been at his side during his entire stay on campus was waiting in the wings with a blinding smile.
That was so amazing, Dr. Pilcher. Oh my God, I'm so inspired.
Thank you, Amber. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Would you mind showing me to the nearest exit?
What about your book signing?
I need a breath of fresh air first. She led him through the backstage corridors, past dressing rooms, to a pair of doors in the back of the building next to a loading bay.
Is everything okay, Dr. Pilcher?
She asked.
Of course.
And you'll be right back? They're already lining up at your signing table. I have a book for you to sign, too. Wouldn't miss it. David pushed through the double doors and stepped out into the alley. The darkness and the quiet and the cold so welcome. The nearby dumpsters reeked, and he could hear the central heating units on top of the auditorium rumbling away. It was that period between Thanksgiving and Christmas, the fall semester drawing to a close, the smell of dead leaves in the air, and the quiet that befalls a campus in advance of exam week. His ride, a black Suburban, was parked in the alley. Arnold Pope, bundled up in a North Face jacket, sat on the hood, reading a book in the light of a street lamp. David walked over.
"How'd it go?" Arnold asked.
"It's over. This tour's over, and that's a good thing."
"You're already done signing?"
"I'm skipping out. Small present to myself."
"Congratulations. Let's get you back downtown." Arnold closed the paperback.
"Not just yet. I want to take a little walk across campus first. If they come asking for me."
"Never saw you. Good man."
David patted his arm and headed off down the alleyway. Pope had been with him now for 4 years, initially on the payroll as a driver, but with his law enforcement background, David had let him branch out into PI work. The man was talented, capable, and scary. David had come to value not only Pope's investigative acumen, but also his counsel. Pope was fast becoming his right-hand man. Crossing Sheridan, he soon found himself walking into an open field. Despite the late hour, the stained glass windows of the library glowed. The sky was clear, the moon climbing over the spires of large Gothic hall in the distance. He'd left his coat in the Suburban, and the cold wind cut through his wool jacket, coming off the lake that was less than a quarter of a mile away. But it felt good. He felt good. Alive. Halfway across Deering Meadow, he caught the scent of cigarette smoke riding on the breeze. 2 steps later, he nearly tripped over her, caught himself, staggered back. Saw the tobacco ember first, and then, as his eyes adjusted in the growing moonlight, the girl behind it.
"Sorry," he said, "I didn't see you there."
She looked up at him, her knees drawn into her chest. Dragging deeply on the cigarette, the ember flaring and fading, flaring and fading. Even in the poor light, he could see she wasn't a student here. David knelt down. She cut her eyes up at him. She was shivering. The backpack in the grass beside her was packed to the gills.
"Are you okay?" he asked.
"Yeah."
"What are you doing out here?"
"How the fuck is that any of your business?" she smoked. "Are you like a professor here?"
"No."
"What are you doing out here in the dark and the cold?"
"I don't know.
Just needed to get away from people for a minute. Clear my head."
"I know the feeling," she said.
As the moon cleared the spires of the hall behind them, its light brightened the girl's face. Her left eye was black, swollen, half-closed.
"Someone hit you," he said. He looked at her backpack again. "You on your own?"
"Of course not."
"I won't turn you in." She smoked her cigarette down to her fingers. Flicking it into the grass, she pulled another one out of her pocket, fired it up.
"That's really bad for you, you know," David said. She shrugged.
"What's the worst that'll happen?"
"You could die."
"Yeah, that'd be so tragic."
"How old are you?"
"How old are you?"
57.
David reached into his pocket, found his wallet, took out all the cash he had.
"This is a little over $200. I'm not going to blow you."
"No, I'm not.
I just want you to have this."
"Seriously?"
"Yeah."
Her hands were shaking with cold as she took the wad of cash.
"You'll get yourself a warm bed tonight?" David asked.
"Yeah, because hotels rent out rooms to 14-year-olds all the damn time."
"It's freezing out here,"
she smirked, a glint of spirit in her eyes.
"I have my methods.
I won't die tonight, don't worry. But I will get a hot meal. Thank you." David stood.
"How long have you been on your own?" he asked.
4 months.
"Winter's coming.
I would rather freeze to death than go back to another foster home. You wouldn't understand.
I grew up in this beautiful neighborhood in Greenwich, Connecticut. Cute little town, just a 40-minute train ride from Grand Central Station. Picket fences, kids playing in the streets. It was the 1950s. You probably don't know who Norman Rockwell is, but it's the kind of place he would have painted. When I was 7 years old, my parents left me with the sitter one Friday evening. They were going to drive into the city to have dinner and see a show. They never came back."
"They left you?"
"They were killed in a car wreck."
"Oh."
"Never assume you know where someone else is coming from."
He walked away, pant legs swishing through the grass. She called out after him.
"I'll be gone by the time you tell the cops you saw me."
"I'm not telling the cops," David said. After 10 more steps, he stopped. He glanced back. Then he walked back. Knelt down in front of her again.
"I knew you were a fucking pervert," she said.
"No, I'm a scientist."
"Listen, I could give you real work. A warm place to stay, safety from the streets, the cops, your parents, child services, whatever it is you're running from."
"Fuck off."
"I'm staying downtown at the Drake Hotel. My last name is Pilcher. I'll already have your very own room waiting for you if you change your mind."
"I wouldn't wait up."
He stood.
"Take care of yourself. I'm David, by the way."
"Have a nice life, David."
"What's your name?"
"What do you care?"
"I honestly don't know."
She rolled her eyes, blew out a stream of smoke.
"Pamela," she said.
"Pam."
David slipped quietly into his suit and hung his coat on the rack beside the door. Elizabeth was sitting in the parlor, reading in the soft light of a floor lamp that overhung the leather chair beside the window. She was 42 years old. Her short blonde hair had begun to lose its vibrancy, yellow considering silver. A stunning winter beauty.
"How'd it go?" she asked.
He leaned down and kissed her.
"It went great."
"So this means you're done?"
"We're done. We're going home."
"You mean to the mountain?"
"That is home now, my love."
David walked over to the window and swept aside the heavy drapes. There was no view of the city, just the lights of late traffic on Lakeshore Drive and the black chasm of the lake beyond, yawning out into darkness. He crossed the suite and carefully opened the door to the bedroom, crept inside. His footfalls soundless on the thick carpeting. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust to the darkness. Then he saw her, curled up in a ball on the immense bed. She had kicked away the blankets and rolled over to the edge. He moved her back into the center of the mattress and covered her again and eased her head gently onto a pillow. His little girl took a deep breath,
but didn't wake. Leaning over, he kissed her on the cheek and whispered, "Sweet dreams, my sweet Alyssa." When he opened the bedroom door, his wife was standing there. "What's wrong, Elizabeth?" "We just had a knock at the door."
"Who was it?"
"A teenage girl. She said her name is Pam, that you told her to come here. She's waiting out in the hallway for you."
Part 2, Chapter 8. Tobias finished tying off his bivy sack and descended the pine tree. In the failing light, he huddled over the circle of rocks and kindling with his flint and steel, building the nerve. It was a risk, always a risk, but it had been weeks since he'd felt the glow of a fire, since he'd steeped pine needles in a pot of boiling water and let something warm run down his throat. He had thoroughly scouted the area, no footprints, no scat, nothing to indicate it was frequented by anything other than a doe and two fawns. He'd seen a tuft of coarse white hair caught in the thorns of a raspberry bush. He struck a spark onto the charcloth. A yellow flame licked up and impaled a bundle of old man's beard that was laced with a dismembered branch of dead fir. The spikes of dried-out, russet-colored needles ignited. Smoke coiled out of the tinder. His heart swelled with primal joy. Tobias built up a cone of sticks over the growing flames and held his hands to the heat. He hadn't bathed since his last river crossing. That had been at least a month ago. He still remembered catching his reflection in the grass-smooth current, beard down to his sternum, skin embedded with dirt. He looked like a caveman. Tobias added a single log to the blaze and leaned back against the tree. He felt reasonably safe in this little grove of pines, but there was no sense in pushing the luck he'd already pushed so many times to the breaking point. At the bottom of his Kelty backpack, he pulled out the 1-liter titanium camp kettle and filled it halfway with water from his last remaining bottle, dropped in a handful of sharp-smelling pine needles fresh off the branch. Kicked back, waiting for his tea to boil, was as close to human as he'd felt in ages. He drank the pot of tea and let the fire die. Before he lost its light completely, he took inventory of the contents of his pack. 6 1-liter water bottles, only half of one still full, flint and steel, a first aid kit down to a single pill of Advil, a dry bag filled with buffalo jerky, pipe, book of matches, and the last of his tobacco, which he was holding on to for his final night, if it ever came, in the wilderness. His last box of 30-30 Winchester cartridges, a .357 Smith & Wesson revolver for which he'd run out of ammo over a year ago, pack fly, a leather-bound journal sealed in plastic. He pulled out a stick of jerky and scraped off the carpeting of mold, allowed himself 5 small bites before returning it to the bag. He finished off the pine tea and packed everything back. Shouldering the pack, he climbed 20 feet to his perch in the tree and fastened the Kelty to a branch. He untied his hiking boots, the soles long since worn through the tread and the leather beginning to disintegrate, and laced them to the tree. He slid his arms out of his barber duster. The coat was months overdue for a thorough waxing, but so far it kept him dry. He maneuvered into the bivy sack and zipped himself in. Wow, he stunk. It was almost like he'd developed his own musk. His mind wouldn't stop running. The chances of a swarm stumbling through this grove of pines were admittedly slim. A small group or a loner, better. Tree bivouacking was a good news, bad news proposition. The good news? It kept him out of the obvious lines of sight. Countless times he'd heard a branch snap in the middle of the night and rolled quietly over to stare down 20 or 30 feet at an abbey creeping past underneath him. The bad news? If one ever looked up, he was treed. He reached down and touched the smooth, leathered handle of his bowie. It was the only real weapon in his arsenal. The Winchester would get him killed in close combat, and he only used it anymore to hunt his food. He slept always with his hand on the knife, sometimes waking in the dark, other side of midnight to find himself clutching it like a talisman.
Strange to think that an object of such violence had assumed a place as comforting in his mind as the memory of his mother's voice. Then he was awake. He could see the sky through the branches above him. His breath steamed in the cold. It was absolutely quiet.